Hello there and welcome to Culture Farm with me, Luke Clancy, and a never quite usual collection of happenings in arts and culture. And this week there's some digging about in the colonial history of the garden at an exhibition at Bray's Mermaid. We hear a calming musical machine that harnesses the power of human humming. Paddy Woodworth will say a few surprising words on Ireland's generous nature in the Naturalist Bookshelf, and we'll barge in on performance poet Rob McGlade as he prepares to warm up the Cork Opera House crowd for David Sedaris. So first, time for some gardener's questions.
What does it mean to decolonise a garden is the question we're still asking through the exhibition. I think if we were to decolonise any garden, it would be incredibly different from how we think it ought to look or how it looks now. My name is Anne Mullee. I'm a visual art curator and creative producer, and I mostly work with artists to devise new work for exhibitions, and I currently work as the curator at Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray in County Wicklow. This exhibition is called Composting Colonialism Towards the Radical Garden, and it arose, as most of the things that I work on do, through lots of coincidences, conversations, and sort of seeing similar themes being addressed through artists, writers, and so on. I had been aware of Elida, in my case, my co-curator's practice. She's an artist who works through horticulture as part of her practice. It's a really central part of her practice. She's a guerrilla gardener. And I had also encountered the work of many of the artists in the exhibition in different shows or through studio visits. And I could see a sort of theme arising around the issue of colonialism, which in this country we are hyper aware of and yet often don't really address head on for our own complex reasons. One of the interesting aspects of thinking about the role of the garden in colonialism was through how many of the formal gardens that we can go and visit on a Sunday here are actually belonging to former big houses. So they in themselves represent an aspect of that part of our history. And they also contain plants that come from all over the world that were often stolen, trafficked, if that's not too an extreme a word to use around plants. But they mirror the colonial experience in lots of ways. And also through Elida's work with the Mermaid Garden Project, which is a project for local community gardeners that she's originated here at Mermaid Arts Centre, I knew that there were people who were struggling to find places to become gardeners. They couldn't grow their own food because they didn't have a garden, they live in an apartment, or they might have a window box and a thriving balcony, but they kind of wanted more and they wanted to also engage with other gardeners and share information and experiences. So all of those things kind of convened, really. One of the artists in the exhibition is Grace Enemaku, who is a Irish-Nigerian artist and illustrator based here in Dublin. And this was a commission, an original commission from Grace to create a world map. Grace was really interested in the triangular trade. The triangular trade is the term that's used for the way that crops were exported, that people were stolen and taken to other places, and where they were taken back to. So goods like cloth, tea, coffee, and tobacco. Grace, she was keen to illustrate that there was great mobility taking place here. We often think of the world as being relatively recently mobile, and actually enormous distances were being covered and enormous journeys were being made, which of course are really, really interesting, but they do kind of illustrate, I suppose, the extent of human ambition and greed.
So let's go have a look at the exhibition.
Yeah. Do you want to start at the beginning or do you want to start at the end?
Let's start at the beginning.
Would you like to turn this down?
Where is it coming from?
Under the tree.
What are we listening to?
We're listening to an original composition by Tara Bauf Mooney and Dermot McDermott, which was commissioned by Port Cunningham for this piece, A Long Way, which is composed of the bark from a Monterey cypress tree.
Collect, control, coerce, corrupt. Veins of trade, dirt for blood. And it's quite long. How many feet is it?
16 feet.
And it's got this gorgeous moth still living on it.
And there's a space blanket draped over it. The kind that you see marathon runners wearing when they're finished.
So it's this sort of like metallic.
Very shiny. In California, they use them to protect the trees during forest fires. So the trees all get a little jacket when there's forest fires threatened to help protect them from that. This is Harald Offa being a hermit in his grotto, Arcadia Reimagined, which is a reimagining again of an earlier work from an exhibition at Ham House in London. He was actually in the garden as the living hermit in the grotto.
Yeah, it looks like big blocks of stone in an archway and then a little kind of cubbyhole where he's sort of standing and looking
contemplative and spiritual, which I think was probably a demand made on the hermits. They were there to perform or kind of look holy and be quiet. In thinking about this exhibition, a really key thing was to think about how do we coexist with the results of the colonized garden? How do we work with what's available, and how do we as gardeners, growers, or if you're not a gardener grower and you'd like to be a gardener grower, begin to engage with that as a kind of everyday practice that's part of your life. Maybe thinking about what we buy at the garden centre, maybe looking for heritage varieties of things to diversify what's grown so that we don't have monocultures within a food type or food crop. So maybe it's to think about all of those things that contribute to a really rich tapestry of what a garden can be.
Niamh Daly made that report from the Composting Colonialism exhibition at the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray, and a helpful, if chunky, handbook for decolonising gardeners just might be Paddy Woodworth's latest pick for storage on the Naturalist bookshelf, an epic volume by Peter Wise Jackson.
Ireland's Generous Nature is a cornucopia of a book, reminding us of the vital roles that plants have played and still play in our lives. From timber to dyes, from food to symbols, from medicines to handicrafts and decorations. The book is lavishly presented, over 750 beautifully illustrated and very helpfully laid out pages. It encompasses the entire field of ethnobotany, the study of the links and relationships between people, cultures and plants. Not only the varied uses of plants, but how they are thought of culturally. It is the brainchild and love child of Peter Wise Jackson, the distinguished Irish botanist who has directed both the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin and, until very recently, the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis, all the while campaigning energetically for plant conservation worldwide. Indeed, there is a keen awareness throughout this book that not only has much lore concerning Irish wild plant use already been lost, but many of the plants themselves are being squeezed through extreme scarcity towards extinction. This book has its origins in Wise Jackson's amazement in 2006, while labelling some plants for an exhibition in Glasnevin. He found that there was no single reliable source of information on our historical use of native plants. Filling this gap was a Herculean task, but one which he has obviously pursued with exuberant and infectious enjoyment. Wise Jackson takes his research very seriously, but he always makes it sound like fun. It took him to the dark and rather spooky overgrown garden around the ruined cottage of Biddy Early, the 19th century wise woman, or witch, from Clare, who was renowned for her healing potions. He was pleased to find that 22 of the 27 plant species he found still there have recorded medicinal uses in Ireland. The book led him to intensify his own lifelong experiments in cooking and gardening with native plants. It is these passages in particular that make the book so accessible to general readers. In a chatty section advising on jam making, he advocates an experimental approach. He concludes, "Remember, if the mixture does not set, no matter what you try, you can always pretend that you meant to make syrup all along and use it as a topping for ice cream and pancakes." The heart of the book is a systematic list of hundreds of plants in Ireland, including conifers, ferns, algae and fungi, with accounts of their known uses. The list is introduced by wide-ranging literary essays on the general uses of wild plants in construction and crafts, children's games, in cooking, brewing and distilling, in horticulture, in medicine, in dyeing and weaving, and even in warfare and murders. The detail is prolific. Peat, which of course is derived from plant detritus, has several obvious uses. But did you know it was employed to make postcards, wool, and even hot rectal douches, though the latter are not recorded for Ireland? Indeed, contemporary foragers for wild food and herbal medicines should note that the author stresses that he does not endorse the efficiency or the safety of reported plant uses. Contemporary foragers for wild food and herbal medicines should note that the author stresses that he does not endorse the efficiency or the safety of reported plant uses. His analysis is often provocative, especially on the respective links between the decline of native plant use and the Irish language, the introduction of the potato and its legacy of famine, and the loss of our woodlands. The plethora of Irish and English language names, often confusingly applied to a single species, now defined by a scientific name, are comprehensively noted. But he also records plant names in the traveller tongue, Shelta, and even in the now extinct Wexford dialect, Yola. Wise Jackson is the first to admit that his work, vast though it is, remains radically incomplete. Traditional knowledge, transmitted orally by the very poor, largely through a language suffering a chronic decline, survives, as he puts it, only as a shadowy hint and fleeting reminder of a rich plant lore that has been lost.
Paddy Woodworth there, sliding Peter Wise Jackson's Ireland's Generous Nature onto the Naturalist bookshelf. And it's the nature of sound next in Linz in Austria at this year's Ars Electronica Festival. The UK-based collective Analemma Group were inviting passers-by to explore their interactive sound and vision work, Chema Resonance, designed to seek out, among other things, calm through collective humming. Culturefile tried humming along.
I'm Dr. Shama Rahman. I'm a neuroscientist and artist working within multimedia and music.
And Shana, you're also a vocalist, which we've just seen. We've just seen the piece in action. Tell us what you were doing there in front of the microphone.
So we were looking at the interplay between different notes, as there was also another participant some of the times, which included yourself here. and we wanted to see the expression of these musical notes in a geometric and mathematical way, visually expressed. Also, we were trying to look at the idea of humming in particular and how that could be very soothing, in the first instance. And people were wearing a brain activity sensing device on their head to be able to look at how soothing that actually was. And the idea is that there's been some research done on humming and the sort of impact on mental health and in general on health. So how we could actually utilize this in a very playful, interesting way in order to even look at this like a musical instrument in some way, utilizing our voice and potentially learning a little bit about how music works.
My name name is Dr. Oliver Gingrich. I am an artist, a researcher, part of the Analemma Group, which is an art collective that is looking at the intersection between sound and vision.
Tell us about how this musical instrument is constructed. What is the there that's there?
Yeah, so what we're looking at, we're analyzing sonically, so the sound input, and then mapping this onto visual expressions. So we are looking specifically at intervals, so sonic ratios really between frequencies, trying to understand where these harmonies occur. And these harmonies are then visually represented as different visual forms, and the whole visual instrument, if you so want, then invites you to explore these harmonies between your voices and to find these resonances between your voice and somebody else's.
There's three participants in each time the instrument is played, and two are singing. Shano is one of those, but somebody is also sort of behind a screen with a headset on that's reading their brainwaves. What's happening there?
We're really interested not just in the act of singing or humming, but also listening, and specifically deep listening or active listening. And so the person, the third person, their only job is to just listen and to listen to these harmonies and see how that really affects the mind. We're wearing an EEG headset. We can actually measure the kind of brain activity. And what is then happening is that this is being visually represented as different colors. And you can almost watch that person listen in real time. We're looking at sound as something that is beyond any Western system or Western conception of music, as something that is also pure frequencies, pure mass. That means that anybody, even people who cannot sing, like myself, are able to tune in into one another and actually kind of harmonize with somebody else, even if they are not a natural singer. These harmonies, these musical intervals, they are something quite specific, quite concrete, something that is physical and that is independent from any kind of culture. And so this, in effect, I think is much more interesting, this interpersonal space and that idea that actually the harmonies really occur when we sing together, right? When we're making music together. I think for me, this is the beauty of this project.
Of course, you say it's distinct from any culture, but it's the culture of physics that that they exist in.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And I would say that's a universal culture, isn't it?
I don't know, is it?
But I think I should add that the sound design that runs behind it is supposed to guide you into your journey, into finding this sort of harmony, which can be very loosely described in the sense that it's something that occurs by, you know, like when you learn an instrument. To go back to the instrument analogy, I'm Alain Renaud. I'm a sound designer specializing in immersive sounds. To reach some sort of, end to it, guided by a sort of sonic feedback loop that would guide you through the experience. But you actually, by singing, by feeding your voice into the system, you are actually making the piece progress in very surprising ways sometimes, and sometimes not.
I mean, as Olive was saying, it's not necessary to be proficient in music, although I did think your voice was very good. But one of the things that it does is sort of unlearns all the things we know about just intonation and 12 tone, etc.
Yeah, it's not based at all on Western harmonies. In fact, it's not based on any scales. It just analyzes the intervals. So basically, those intervals will generate visuals, but they will also generate sounds. And it's not based on any type of Western scaling system or whatever. Especially that users who are using the installations are not most of the time professionals. So it's really, again, to guide you through a process that you discover by yourself. And there's this very powerful, as Sharma was saying, this very powerful humming idea, which is a very ancient tradition. Humming is really, it's always been everywhere, almost like as old as speaking. And that's really one thing we are trying to explore sonically and obviously visually. But again, it's supposed to be self-guided. So you're not, you know, the goal is not to come up with a traditional third or fourth or fifth like you would do when you play the piano or when you play the guitar. It's really, you know, sometimes you have some harmonies that have nothing to do with each other and that actually, through this installation, yield some really interesting results.
So that's what you would have seen. I was kind of playing a little bit with dissonance even and being super close to somebody else's note, which can sometimes cause a little beating effect when you just hear it in an audio way. But I mean, voice is one, but there's plenty of non-Western musical instruments like the sitar, which I play, which go through all of these kinds of microtonal spaces. So it would be really interesting to see if, stringed instruments can also produce this kind of visuals.
We're working with people with disabilities on co-design sessions to make it more accessible to others. It is now exists not just as a site-specific installation, but as an online installation. So anybody can just log in on www.participateresearch.co.uk and sing with themselves or with somebody else anywhere around the world.
The humming of Analemma Group's Chema Resonance at this year's Ars Electronica. And finally, this time, we magically duck into the changing room at Cork Opera House, where Rob McGlade is warming up.
I'm Rob McGlade, and I'm sitting in my dressing room right now, as you're hearing this right now, at this exact moment in time, and I am about to go out on stage at the Cork Opera House, which, according to Nationwood, I believe is 170 years old, which is quite fascinating, to be honest. I'm not that old now myself, but I'm about to open for David Sedaris to promote my new book, which is a memoir called Bitter Bastard Batter Burger. And it's like about me life and all that, you know? It is Sedaris, yeah. I called him Sedaris at the start as well. I first met David in Edinburgh in 2022. Edinburgh is where I live. And I gave him a copy of my debut book of poems, Vinegar, because somebody read that book and they said, "You remind me of David Sedaris." And my partner Monica convinced me to approach David. And he opened the book and liked the author photo, which is an unflattering picture of me in the shower from the chest up, I should say. Straight on the spot, he just asked me, did I want to open for him in Dublin 3 days later? The first night opening for David went better than I could have ever expected, really. And he invited me then to open for him in Glasgow, and that went well. And then 2 dates in London at Royal Festival Hall. Then I did the Edinburgh Fringe that year, and then David asked me to come to Australia. So I did 2 dates in Melbourne and 1 date in the Sydney Opera House. And then he asked me to America, did LA and New York, and then went to Europe and did Berlin, Amsterdam and Copenhagen. And I've been back and forth to North America a few times, so Canada, and last year did New York and LA again and the Kennedy Center in October. Look, you know what they say, he who dares is willing to be daring. And I dare you, dear listener, to come with me to the place that we never talked about, yet always inferred. Here I am. Listen to me.
My latest book is called Bitter Bastard Batter Burger. It's a memoir about trying to write a memoir. And it's inspired by books like Tristram Shandy or Don Quixote even, as well as memoir itself. But also the language of Hiberno English that we speak, and kind of mixing that with surrealism and or a League of Ireland fan talking on O'Connell Street, where he's accidentally improvising. He was interviewed on O'Connell Street in 2011 asked, does he like Irish football? And he said he did. And his team was St. Pat's, happens to be my team as well. And his favourite player is the fella in the green and white jersey, even though Pats don't or never have worn green as a main colour. And he starts rambling in this kind of way that you do when you're being put in front of a camera and just ask questions. Very similar to what I'm doing right now, yes, and the entire book. But he's asked about English football, and I'm paraphrasing, but the Queen was supposed to come over, and he was saying people were annoyed that the Queen was coming over, but they don't mind supporting the Queen's football teams. And he surprised himself and turned to the camera as if he was presenting and said, that's actually a good point. It's kind of like a eureka moment. I don't see any difference between him and Miles Davis turning into a riff, you know, and going, oh, wow, what is this? So that was the basis for the entire book. He's improvising. That man is improvising in the moment. And maybe he's doing it a lot throughout his life. But it's not just funny, but kind of heartwarming as well, you know. Yeah. All any one of us can ever do is try to answer a question when we're on camera. And most people are not going to answer very well in the moment, you know. So I think he did stumble across some brilliance there. I've showered in words, washed my oxters in pure punctuation, bathed in the soup of my own ladled grammar. And I took to that liquid like a duck takes to sitting. Of course, this book wasn't written in one sitting. I wasn't even sitting for the writing of most of it. Yeah, for a lot of my writing, I like to upstand, like some of the city's very best citizens. Which is why I want to say, if I ever get angry, if I do, and it's a small if, because it's very likely, please do not think that it is aimed at you. The recipient, if indeed there is a recipient, is the book itself, the work itself. It is itself, myself, me. You read Tristram Shandy today, what is it, 200 odd years later, and it's still amazingly funny. And what I really like about it is how difficult it is, not in the kind of Finnegan's Wake difficult, which I also enjoy, but you know, that can be baffling at times. Difficult as in Lawrence Stern is not going to pander to anybody in any of his digressions. Here's a story, but before I tell you that story, here's another story about the story, or as Tristram says himself, if you take out the digressions, then you might as well take the whole story itself. So the book is about nothing really, but I think the best books usually are. There really isn't any point in trying to make my memoir look like another memoir just because that memoir looks like a memoir. And that memoir only looks like a memoir because the market has dictated what looks like a memoir based on sales. And sales of memoirs show that there is a market for a certain type of memoir. So writers write that type of memoir in the hope that it will sell like that type of memoir. And then it does sell like that type of memoir, and then even more memoirs look the same. Once someone expects their work not to be likeable, it immediately makes it more likeable to anything where someone wants it to be likeable. I mean, I never really understood the thing of, oh, I want people to like this. You know, maybe let them decide.
It's actually a good point. You know what I'm trying to say? Yeah.
It actually is. Rob McGlade, who supports David Sedaris at Cork Opera House at 7:30 tonight and in Dublin tomorrow evening at Bord Gáis Energy Theatre and on Monday at the Ulster Hall in Belfast, 7:30 each night. And obviously don't miss the support. Colm Tobin will be back with us on Saturday for The Comfort Zone when we'll be watching John Borman's 1987 film Hope and Glory. Till then, bye now.